This is a Power Broadcast program. More information at powerbroadcast.com.
So today we are tackling, well, probably the most fundamental blueprint of existence, the molecule of life itself.
We're talking about DNA, specifically its structure. You know, that famous double helix shape is so iconic, it's almost a cliche.
It is, and I think most of us just see that static image in our heads, but our mission today is to go way beyond that.
Way beyond.
We're going to unpack the intense drama, the scientific race, and the often controversial evidence that led to that breakthrough in 1953.
And then, and this is the really exciting part for me, we're jumping into the last 70-plus years of discovery.
Where it turns out DNA isn't this monotonous, boring coil at all.
Not even close. It's a molecule with this incredibly rich, dynamic structural diversity. It can do things that would have been unimaginable back then.
It's amazing. To kick things off, though, we have to start with that famous paper, April 25th, 1953.
The Nature paper, just 900 words.
Yeah.
And it ends with what has to be the biggest understatement in the history of science.
I love this line.
They just casually drop in. It has not escaped our notice that the specific pairing we have postulated immediately suggests a possible copying mechanism for the genetic material.
It's so unbelievably British. It's like, oh, by the way, we've just figured out the secret of life.
Right. Just a small thought we had.
Yeah.
But that one sentence, it's the seed for everything.
Everything. It explains replication. It gives a physical basis for genetics.
And it lays the groundwork for all of modern biotechnology. Gene therapy, forensics, diagnostics. It all traces back to understanding that physical structure.
So let's rewind. Before we get to Watson and Crick and the drama, what did we actually know before 1953? Because they weren't starting from zero, were they?
No, not at all. You can't see this discovery as happening in a vacuum. It was really a synthesis of decades of work. Scientists knew a lot about the chemical facts of DNA.
The ingredients.
Exactly. They just didn't have the recipe. They didn't know how those ingredients fit together in three-dimensional space.
Okay, so let's unpack those foundations. What were the absolute must-know building blocks?
Well, for that, you have to go back to the early 20th century, and a biochemist named Phoebus Levine.
Levine.
He was the one who figured out the basic molecular composition. He determined that DNA is a polymer, a chain made of repeating units called nucleotides.
Right, and each nucleotide has three parts.
Yep, a phosphate group, which is negatively charged, a 5-carbon sugar, which in DNA is deoxyribose.
Hence the D in DNA.
Precisely. And then one of 4 nitrogenous bases.
The famous 4 letters, A, C, G, and T.
Adenine, cytosine, guanine, and thymine. Levine even knew how they were linked up, sort of. He knew it was a chain, with the phosphate and sugar groups alternating to form what we now call the backbone.
But his model was basically a flat 2-dimensional line drawing.
It was. It was a chemical formula on a page.
Yeah.
The magic, the ability to store and transmit all that information had to come from its 3D structure, and he had no idea about that.
Which brings us to the next really crucial piece of the puzzle. This one is from just a few years before, 1949.
Right. Erwin Chargaff.
Chargaff's rules. I definitely remember this from biology class.
We all do.
Yeah.
And his discovery was so elegant because it wasn't about structure. It was about numbers. He's basically just a bookkeeper. He took DNA from dozens of different species.
Humans, bacteria, plants, everything.
Everything he could get his hands on. And he meticulously counted the relative amounts of the 4 bases.
And he found this incredibly consistent pattern, didn't he?
A stunningly consistent pattern. He found that the amount of adenine, A, was always almost exactly equal to the amount of thymine, T.
So A equals T.
And similarly, the amount of cytosine, C, was always equal to the amount of guanine, G.
C equals G.
It's so simple when you say it now, but what's wild is that this was public knowledge. Everyone knew about Chargaff's ratios.
But no one knew why.
Exactly. No one connected it to the physical structure. They were all sort of stuck on this idea that DNA was maybe just a monotonous stack like ACGT repeating over and over again.
Which Chargaff's work proved was wrong. The ratios were different in different species, but the ATCG rule was universal.
Right. The data was literally screaming pairing. At them.
But they couldn't hear it yet.
They couldn't because they were missing the geometric constraints.
Yeah.
The physical dimensions. And that takes us to the third foundational pillar.
King's College London.
And the really difficult experimental work being done there by Maurice Wilkins, Rosalind Franklin, and a PhD student, Raymond Gosling.
This is where we get the first real glimpse of the molecule shape. Using X-rays, how does that even work?
It's incredibly difficult technique. especially for a biological molecule. DNA doesn't form nice, big, neat crystals like, say, salt.
So what do you do?
They had to pull these incredibly fine, almost invisible fibers of purified DNA. They'd stretch them to align all the molecules in the same direction, creating a semi-crystalline arrangement.
And then they shoot X-rays at it.
Exactly. When the X-rays hit the regularly repeating parts of the molecules, they scatter or diffract in a predictable way, the pattern of spots that you capture on a piece of film.
That pattern contains the geometric information.
It contains the geometry. It showed that DNA had this great symmetry and consistency. And crucially, it gave them the hard numbers, the dimensions.
How wide the molecule was, how often the pattern repeated.
All of it. It proved the structure was highly ordered, and it gave the model builders like Watson and Crick the physical rules they had to play by.
So you have the chemical parts from Levine, the mathematical rule from Chargaff, and the spatial measurements from Kings. The stage is set.
The stage is set. And now the race begins.
Right. And it's a real race. You have this atmosphere of intense competition in the early 1950s.
It really was.
Uh-huh.
So at Cambridge, you have James Watson and Francis Crick. Watson's a young American, originally an ornithologist, who got obsessed with genetics. Crick is a British physicist.
And they're not doing the hard lab work. They're theorists.
They're model builders, literally. They're using bits of metal, wire, and cardboard cutouts to try and build a physical model that fits all the known data.
Meanwhile, back at King's College, Wilkins and Franklin are taking the opposite approach.
The experimental approach. They're trying to solve the structure from first principles using math to decode their X-ray images.
Yeah.
It's a much slower, more meticulous process.
But the funny thing is, the biggest perceived threat wasn't each other.
No, not at all. Everyone was looking over their shoulder at Caltech. In the U.S.
Linus Pauling.
The most famous chemist in the world.
Yeah.
An absolute titan of science. He had just discovered the alpha helical structure of proteins. And everyone knew he had turned his attention to DNA.
The assumption was that Pauling was going to solve it any day now.
Absolutely. The pressure was on. And that pressure led Watson and Crick to rush things.
Their first attempt at a model around 1951.
And it was a complete and utter disaster. Just a spectacular failure.
What did they propose?
It was a three-stranded helix, which is already a bad guess. But the real fatal flaw was the chemistry. They put the phosphate backbone.
The repeating sugar phosphate chain.
They put it right up the middle of the helix with the bases pointing outwards.
Okay, why is that an immediate disqualifying error?
Because the King's College group, especially Franklin, knew from their experiments that DNA was full of water. The phosphate groups carry a strong negative charge, and they love to bind to water molecules.
And if you cram all those negatively charged groups together in the middle of a molecule,
you get massive electrostatic repulsion. They would push each other apart. The structure would be incredibly unstable. And crucially, it couldn't bind to all that water that Franklin knew had to be there.
So the King's group saw this model and just immediately shot it down.
Instantly. They knew it was wrong based on hard experimental evidence. The whole episode was so embarrassing that the head of the Cambridge lab, Sir Lawrence Bragg, was furious.
And he actually banned them from working on DNA.
He did. He told them to stop speculating and leave the problem to the experts at King's.
But that ban didn't last very long.
No, because word got out that Pauling was about to publish his own structure. The race was back on.
And then, in a kind of amazing twist, Pauling makes the same mistake.
It's incredible. The greatest chemist in the world publishes his proposed structure, and it's also a triple helix with the phosphates incorrectly jammed on the inside.
Even he couldn't figure it out.
It gave Watson and Crick the breathing room they needed. It was a huge confidence boost. They knew Pauling was on the wrong track, which meant the race was still wide open.
And it refocused them. They knew now for sure that the backbone had to be on the outside and the bases had to be pointing in.
Right. And that brings us to the central figure of the experimental side of this story. Rosalind Franklin.
Her work was absolutely key to this. She was recruited to King's for her specific expertise, right?
Yes. She was an expert in X-ray crystallography, known for being incredibly meticulous and having amazing experimental skill. She refined the whole process, improving the equipment and the sample preparation.
And it was her work with her student Raymond Gosling that led to a key realization about DNA itself.
That it existed in two distinct forms. It all depended on the humidity of the environment.
Right. The A form and the B form.
In low humidity, they got what she called the A form, which was more crystalline and easier to analyze. In high humidity, which is closer to the conditions inside a cell, they got the B form.
And she decided the B form was the biologically relevant one.
She did. Though, ironically, she decided to focus on solving the A-form structure first, because the data was a bit clearer. And that probably slowed her down.
But in the process of studying the B-form, she and Gosling produced probably the most famous scientific photograph in history.
Photo 51.
Photo 51.
It was taken by Gosling in May 1952, under Franklin's direct supervision. And it's a stunningly beautiful image, a perfectly crisp, clear diffraction pattern of B-form DNA.
And the key feature is that big, dark, cross-shaped pattern in the middle, the X.
That X is the telltale signature. In X-ray diffraction, a pattern like that says one thing and one thing only.
It's a helix.
It's a helix. There's no ambiguity. And more than that, the angle of the X tells you the pitch of the helix, how steep the spiral is. And the distance between the spots tells you the repeating distances along the axis.
All the key dimensions were right there in that one photograph.
They were. And here's where the human drama really kicks in.
This is the controversial part of the story.
Right. So Franklin was preparing to leave King's for another job. She had a difficult working relationship with Maurice Wilkins.
That's putting it mildly.
And so, in early 1953, Wilkins is shown photo 51. And then, without Franklin's knowledge or permission, Wilkins shows this photograph to James Watson, who was visiting from Cambridge.
And Watson, even though he had no formal training in crystallography, he immediately gets it.
He immediately understood the implications. He saw the X and knew, absolutely, it was a helix. Okay. All his and Crick's theoretical work on helices snapped into focus.
So that confirmed the overall architecture. But the biggest puzzle still remained.
The inside. How did the bases pair up in the middle to explain Chargaff's rules and maintain the constant width that the X-ray data demanded? They just couldn't make the pieces fit.
The geometry was right, but the chemistry seemed wrong, at least according to the textbooks they were using.
Precisely. And the final piece of the puzzle came from a seemingly minor conversation.
With a visiting chemist named Jerry Donahue.
Right. Donahue was sharing an office with him, and he was an expert on the chemical structure of these bases. And he pointed out a fundamental mistake that, well, the entire scientific community was making.
And what was that mistake?
It was about something called tautomerism. It's about how hydrogen atoms can shift around within a molecule, changing its bonding properties.
Okay.
The standard chemistry textbooks of the day showed the bases guanine and thymine in a rare, less stable configuration. It's called the enol form.
So the textbook diagram was technically correct, but not the form that actually exists most of the time.
Exactly. Donahue insisted that the much more common stable form, the keto form, was the correct one to use in their model. It changes where the hydrogen atoms are, and therefore how they can form hydrogen bonds.
And when Watson took that advice?
He went back to his cardboard cutouts of the bases, but this time he cut them out in the correct chemical shape that Donahue had insisted on.
This is the famous moment, February 28th, 1953.
It's the moment of synthesis.
Yeah.
He's playing with these new cardboard shapes, yeah. And he's trying to enforce Chargaff's rules. A has to pair with T, C has to pair with G.
And suddenly,
it all just works. He realized that the shape of the AT pair and the shape of the CG pair were identical.
Not just that they could bond together.
But that they were the same size.
Yeah.
They fit perfectly inside the helix, keeping the two backbones at an exact uniform distance from each other, which was exactly what the X-ray data from King's demanded.
It was the physical explanation for everything. For Chargaff's ratios, for the X-ray dimensions, for the chemistry.
Everything snapped into place at once. It's one of the most beautiful and elegant solutions in the history of science.
So let's break down the final model they published, the classic canonical B-DNA structure.
Okay, so first and foremost, it's a double helix. Two strands twisted around each other.
The backbones, made of the alternating sugar and phosphate groups, are on the outside.
Right, forming this stable, negatively charged scaffold that interacts with the water in the cell.
And the nitrogenous bases, the A, C, G, and T.
They're all pointed inward into the core of the helix, stacked on top of each other like a spiral staircase. This is key, because that's where the genetic information is stored, protected on the inside.
And the pairing is specific. Adenine always pairs with thymine,
forming two hydrogen bonds.
And cytosine always pairs with guanine,
forming three hydrogen bonds, which makes the CG pair slightly more stable than the AT pair.
And this specific pairing is what keeps the width of the helix perfectly uniform all the way down.
Exactly. A big base, a purine like A or G, always pairs with a small base, and pyrimidine like C or T. So the total width is always the same. It explains the 20 angstrom diameter from the X-ray data perfectly.
And one other crucial detail is that the two strands are anti-parallel. What does that mean?
It means they run in opposite directions. You can think of a DNA strand as having a chemical directionality, a 5' end, and a 3' end.
Based on the carbon atoms in the sugar ring?
Right. So if one strand runs 5' to 3' from top to bottom, its partner strand runs 3' to 5'. They are inverted relative to each other.
And why is that so important for how DNA actually works?
It's absolutely fundamental for replication. The enzymes that copy DNA can only read a strand in one direction, the 3' to 5' direction. The anti-parallel arrangement is essential for the entire copying machinery to function.
Which brings us back to that famous understatement. The model didn't just describe a static molecule, it immediately explained its function.
It was the ultimate form as function moment in biology. The second you see that complementary pairing A with T, C with G, you understand how heredity works.
The two strands can unwind.
And each one serves as a perfect template for building a new complementary strand. An A on the old strand dictates that a T must be put in the new one. A G dictates a C.
So you end up with two identical copies from one original. It explains how genetic material is passed on perfectly every time a cell divides.
It was the solution to the most fundamental question in biology. And they didn't stop there. They also immediately realized how the information itself was stored.
The genetic code.
Yes. They proposed that the code was written in the linear sequence of the bases. It's a language with a 4-letter alphabet.
And Crick did this amazing back-of-the-envelope calculation.
Right, he did. He estimated that the amount of DNA packed into a single human cell, if you were to print out its sequence, would fill about 1,000 large textbooks. It gives you a sense of the incredible information density.
The whole discovery was, of course, recognized with the Nobel Prize in 1962.
Yes, the prize in physiology or medicine was awarded to Watson, Crick, and Maurice Wilkins.
And this, of course, brings us back to Rosalind Franklin. Her data, specifically photo 51, was undeniably one of the most critical pieces of evidence.
It really was. Without that photo, Watson wouldn't have had that eureka moment.
Yeah.
He wouldn't have known for sure that it was a helix with those specific dimensions.
But she wasn't awarded the prize.
No. Tragically, she died of ovarian cancer in 1958, 4 years before the prize was given. And the Nobel Committee has a long-standing rule against awarding prizes posthumously.
So she was ineligible. But the controversy goes deeper than that, doesn't it?
It does. It's about the lack of acknowledgement she received at the time and the fact that her crucial data was shown to a competitor without her consent. It's a really complex part of the history of science.
How should we view her contribution today?
I think you have to see it as absolutely foundational. The model building of Watson and Crick was brilliant, but it needed to be constrained by hard experimental data. Franklin provided that critical constraint. Without her work, the structure would not have been solved in 1953. Her contribution was essential.
Okay, so that discovery was the foundation. But the story absolutely does not end there. In fact, that's almost just the beginning.
It really is. For a while, there was this sense that, okay, we've solved DNA. It's a double helix. It's a bit monotonous and boring.
I've heard that quote before from a crystallographer who thought there was nothing left to learn.
Right. And that idea has been just completely blown out of the water in the last, say, 50 years.
Thanks to better technology.
Much better technology. High-resolution, single-crystal X-ray studies, powerful NMR techniques.
Mm-hmm.
We now have the structures of over 2,000 different DNA molecules in our databases.
And they've revealed that DNA is highly polymorphic. It's a shapeshifter.
It's a total shapeshifter. It can adopt all these different previously unimagined structures. And let's start with BDNA itself, the classic Watson-Crick helix. Even that isn't a perfectly uniform, rigid rod.
So the structure inside our cells has local variations.
Exactly. The overall shape is BDNA, but the specific sequence of bases causes subtle local changes in the geometry.
The first proof of this came from a famous crystal structure, right? The Dickerson-Dreed-Dodekamer.
Yes, a 12-base pair piece of DNA. Its structure confirmed the general Watson-Crick model, but it also showed these fascinating sequence-dependent details.
What kind of details?
Things we describe with parameters like propeller twist or roll. Basically, the base pairs aren't perfectly flat. They can twist and bend relative to each other. For example, in the middle of that Dodekamer, in the AATT region, the minor groove of the helix gets distinctly narrower.
The minor groove being the shallower of the two grooves that run down the helix.
Correct. And that narrowing creates a unique little pocket that attracts a highly ordered network of water molecules.
It's called the spine of hydration.
Exactly. And that spine of water actually helps to stabilize that specific BDNA conformation. Different sequences have different flexibility, too. A TA step is very flexible and easy to bend. A GC step is much more rigid.
And this flexibility isn't a bug, it's a feature. DNA has to bend to do its job.
It's absolutely critical. DNA in the cell is constantly interacting with proteins for gene regulation, for replication, for repair. Many of those proteins recognize not just the sequence, but the shape of the DNA. They recognize specific bends or widths of the groove.
Okay, so bDNA itself is more complex than it looks, but what about totally different shapes? What happens if you, say, change the environment?
If you dehydrate DNA, taking away the water, it snaps into a completely different right-handed helix called aDNA.
aDNA.
It's shorter and much wider than bDNA. It has about 11 base pairs per turn instead of 10.5, and the base pairs are tilted at a steep angle relative to the axis. It's a really different structure.
Is it biologically relevant?
It is. It's often the structure that DNA-RNA hybrids adopt, and it's been seen in some viruses that have evolved to protect their DNA from drying out.
And what about even more complex shapes, things that aren't just a simple duplex?
Well, a critical one is the holiday junction. This is a structure that forms when two DNA duplexes cross over each other.
Creating a four-way junction.
Exactly. And this structure is the physical intermediate for genetic recombination, the process that shuffles our genes around during meiosis.
Mm.
Seeing the crystal structure of a holiday junction proved that this fundamental genetic process was physically possible.
So we have variations of right-handed helices. But then came the real bombshell in the field.
The big one. 1980. The discovery of a left-handed helix.
zDNA.
It came as a complete shock to the community. Everyone had just assumed that DNA was universally right-handed.
And this stuff twists the other way. What kind of sequence does that?
It's typically found in sequences with alternating cytosine and guanine bases, CG, CG, CG. And it's stabilized by high salt concentrations or by the twisting stress that builds up in DNA.
It's called zDNA because the backbone has this zigzag pattern. What's happening on a molecular level to make it go left?
It's a fundamental flip in the orientation of the bases. In normal bDNA, the bases are all in what's called the anti-conformation. To form zDNA, the guanine bases have to physically rotate 180 degrees into the syn conformation.
That flip is what forces the backbone to zigzag and the whole helix to twist to the left.
Exactly.
Is this just a laboratory curiosity, or does it happen in our bodies?
Oh, it happens. Z-forming sequences are found throughout our genomes. We now know it's bound by specific proteins, especially some involved in the immune response, and its formation can sometimes trigger genetic instability. It's a dynamic, functional structure.
Okay, so we've gone from two strands right-handed to two strands left-handed. Now let's get into what was once considered total heresy. DNA structures that aren't a duplex at all.
Four-stranded DNA.
G-quadruplexes.
This is truly beyond the double helix.
Mm-hmm.
These structures, also called G4s, can form in regions of the genome that are very rich in the base guanine.
So how are four strands held together? It's not Watson-Crick pairing, is it?
Not at all. The fundamental building block is something called a G-quartet.
A G-quartet.
Imagine four guanine bases arranged in a flat square. They bond to each other using a different type of hydrogen bond called a Hoogsteen bond.
Okay, wait. Hoogsteen bonds? How are they different?
Watson-Crick bonds form across the center of the helix. Hoogsteen bonds use a different edge of the guanine base, allowing it to form this planar, square arrangement. These flat G-quartets then stack on top of each other like poker chips.
Creating a four-stranded column. But what holds the stack together?
This is the absolutely essential part. There has to be a metal ion, a cation, in the middle.
Like potassium.
Potassium is the perfect fit.
Yeah.
The stacked quartets create this central channel, and a potassium ion sits right in the middle, coordinating with oxygen atoms from all four guanines. Without that potassium ion, the whole structure falls apart.
That's amazing. So where in our bodies do we find these four-stranded structures?
Two really critical places. The first is in our telomeres.
The protective caps at the ends of our chromosomes.
Right. Human telomeres are made of the repeating sequence TTTG. And that GGG repeat is perfect for folding into incredibly stable G quadruplexes. They protect the chromosome ends from being degraded.
And the second area is a massive focus for cancer research.
It is. They're found in the promoter regions of genes.
The on-off switches.
Exactly. And they're particularly common in the promoters of many major oncogenes genes that drive cancer, like CMYC, KRAS, and BRAF.
So the idea is if you can stabilize the quadruplex, you can turn the gene off.
That's the therapeutic strategy.
Yeah.
The G-quadruplex structure can block the transcription machinery. So researchers are designing small molecule drugs that specifically bind to and stabilize these quadruplexes, effectively jamming the on switch of a cancer gene.
It's an entirely new way of thinking about cancer therapy based on DNA structure. And just to push the weirdness envelope even further, DNA can be an enzyme.
Yes. It's not just a passive information molecule. Just like RNA, DNA can fold up into complex 3D shapes that give it catalytic activity.
Deoxyribozymes.
Deoxyribozymes. We have crystal structures of them. It just completely shatters the myth that DNA's only job is to sit there and be read. It can be an active player.
So to understand all this incredible structural diversity, we rely on modern tools that were, pure science fiction in the 1950s.
Completely. The whole field now rests on this foundation of shared data and powerful computational tools.
Primarily, massive public databases.
Exactly. The most important one is the Protein Data Bank, or PDB.
Which is a bit of a misnomer because it holds more than just proteins.
Right. It's the central worldwide archive for every 3D structure of a large biological molecule that's ever been solved. That includes all of the roughly 2,000 DNA and RNA structures.
And if you're a specialist and need even more detail,
then you go to the Nucleic Acid Database, or NDB. It takes the basic coordinate data from the PDB and adds layers of specialized analysis. Backbone angles, sugar conformations, all the fine-grained geometric parameters you need to do deep comparative studies.
These databases also serve as a kind of scientific self-correction mechanism, don't they?
They're vital for that.
Yeah.
Every structure that gets submitted to the PDB now goes through this rigorous automated validation process. It checks for things that are chemically or physically unrealistic.
So it can catch errors in published research.
It has. There was a famous case with a quadruplex structure from Oxytrichinova. Two different groups published a structure, and the PDB validation tools clearly showed that the older structure had numerous errors, while the newer, more refined one was correct. That public accountability is crucial.
Let's shift to what I think is maybe the most mind-bending modern finding. It's a reassessment of the most fundamental rule of all, the pairing.
Right. We are all taught from day one that the whole system works because of the hydrogen bonds, two between A and T, three between C and G.
But is that really the most important factor?
It's a huge paradigm shift. The new evidence suggests maybe not. If you look at the geometry, the distance across the helix from the backbone on one side to the backbone on the other is almost exactly 10.85 angstroms for all four base pairs.
So the size, the physical shape of the pair, is the constant.
The shape is the constant, the geometry. This suggests that steric fit, how well the pieces physically fit together, might be the primary driver, not the hydrogen bonds.
And there was a killer experiment that proved this.
A brilliant experiment using a molecule called difluorotoluene, or DFT.
What is DFT?
It's a chemical mimic of thymine. It has almost the exact same size and shape as thymine, but, and this is the critical part, it has been chemically engineered so that it is completely unable to form hydrogen bonds.
Okay, so if the hydrogen bond theory is correct, when a DNA copying enzyme sees this fake bondless thymine, it should get confused or stop.
It should make a mistake or just stall. That's the prediction.
But that's not what happened.
Not at all. The experiments showed that the DNA polymerase replicated right past it, and it efficiently and specifically inserted an adenine opposite the DFT.
Wow.
The enzyme recognized the shape of the pair, not the bonds. It suggests that shape complementarity is the primary mechanism for recognition. The enzyme is basically using a molecular ruler. Does this pair have the correct 10.85 angstrom width? If yes, it's accepted.
So the hydrogen bonds are more for stability, for locking the correct pair in place, but not for the initial recognition.
That seems to be the new thinking. Geometry is the gatekeeper. Hydrogen bonding is the glue. It's a subtle but really profound change in our understanding.
Now, we should probably loop back quickly to how all this structural nuance plays out inside the cell, where DNA isn't just floating around.
Right. In the nucleus, you have about 2 meters of DNA that has to be crammed into a microscopic space. To do that, it's wrapped around these protein spools called histones.
Forming nucleosomes, the basic units of chromatin.
Exactly. And that wrapping process requires the DNA to make incredibly tight bends. It has to wrap almost twice around each histone core.
And its ability to do that depends on the local flexibility we talked about earlier.
Precisely. The sequences with those highly flexible TA and TT steps are preferentially located at the points where the DNA needs to bend the most. The intrinsic shape and flexibility of the bDNA sequence itself actually dictates how it can be packaged into chromosomes.
The subtle variations are essential for its large-scale function.
They are. The idea of a monotonous, boring molecule is well and truly gone.
So, to sum this all up, we started this deep dive with that simple, elegant double helix from 1953, the blueprint for life.
And we end with this picture of a wildly dynamic polymorphic molecule. It can be right-handed, left-handed, four-stranded. It can even be an enzyme. It's far more complex and versatile than anyone first imagined.
That initial belief that the structure was solved has just been completely refuted by thousands of detailed structures over the last 70 years.
And what's really striking to me is that we've still only barely scratched the surface.
How so?
Well, if you look at the math, think about all the possible short sequences of DNA. For example, all the possible four base pair sequences, the tetranucleotides. There are 136 unique possibilities.
Okay.
The data shows that we only have experimental structures for a small fraction of those in our databases. The vast majority of the possible structural landscape has never even been seen experimentally.
And that is the final thought we want to leave you with. We've learned so much, but we've really only sampled a tiny corner of DNA's full structural potential. What other shapes are out there, coded by sequences we haven't studied yet?
Could there be novel triple helices? Or five-stranded structures? Or entirely new catalytic folds we can't even predict? And what unknown biological roles might they be playing inside our cells right now?
The journey to truly understand the complexity of our own genetic material is, it seems, far from over.
Very far. We're still just beginning.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the true complexity of DNA.